Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Peter Buchvar. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Peter is chief investment officer for the Bleakley Financial Group and Advisory. He has a newsletter product called the Book Report, BOOKREPORT.com, which has great macroeconomic insight and perspective with lots of updates on economic indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks, Rich.
Thanks, Richard. Nice to be back with you.
Great. Thought we'd begin. Ira, you mentioned a number of issues that are happening globally and, why there isn't much pricing in on those concerns. You mentioned tariffs, trade wars, strife between friends and allies, political uncertainty in Europe, Middle East conflagrations, Russia-Saudi alliance on energy, Chinese growth concerns, rising U.S. interest rates and increased QT, decrease in capital inflows into emerging markets, U.S. congressional elections, you mentioned all that. And then you ask, why are the markets not pricing in these concerns? Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think when it comes down to people asking, yes, everybody knows all these things. We see them, and yet the market, kind of looks at it and for the most part sloughs it off. In fact, I find the market right now fairly interesting. It's like they're waiting for somebody from the White House to come and re-spin what was put out yesterday at about 10 to 5 Eastern time and 10 to 4 my time, right before Globex actually shut down. And of course, it caused a lot of turmoil in the market. The market is actually trying to write its, trying to find its way here through all of this. Initially, the dollar sold off, and then it's spent the whole day rallying. But I think it remains this way because when you still look at the cost of money, the real cost of money, meaning real yields. As well as nominal, real yields outside the United States. In the United States, if you look at short-term rates, are just about at, let's say, zero, or though Peter will say that they're probably still negative by about 30 or 40 basis points, even if we say Fed funds are 2%, and I'm not going to argue with that because he's right. But in Europe, nominal yields are real yields are severely negative, nominal and real. So there is still availability to funds. Yes, there's a little bit of a dollar squeeze for some of the mergers, but they'll find their way around this. And I think that's why they won't be hit as hard as a lot of people think, the emerging markets anyway, because there's still a lot of funding to be had. That's why I think the market sits here in the way that it does.
And Peter, your thoughts on all these factors not being priced in?
I think the market, at least the equity market, they don't respond until something is staring them right in the face. I mean, you go back to 2007. First of all, the housing market started to soften in late 2005, all through 2006. The credit market started to blow up in early 2007. And the U.S. equity market hit an all-time record high in October 2007, because they were all excited that the Fed was cutting rates and was going to save everything. So I think that the market is still riding, oh, the economy's good, earnings are good, and I don't need to sell my stocks yet. And yes, tariffs are an issue, and the Fed raising rates are an issue, and all these other factors that you mentioned are issues. But until it actually starts to impact the data, I don't think the market is necessarily going to respond. I think the market lost its discounting mechanism in a way, unfortunately, a while ago. And while I think this is short-sighted considering my viewpoints on these macro factors, if I were to try to figure out an explanation, I think that would be it.
Okay. And any thoughts on that, Ira, just as a feedback from Peter's comments?
No, I think that's right. And I know Peter and I shared a chart. I sent one yesterday. There is a lag effect. You know, everybody talks about the flattening curves and, well, this time it doesn't matter, that time. But, you know, I have maintained, as long as we've been doing these, Richard, and we've talked about it, there is a lag effect. I don't know the exact measurement. I'd be a fool to tell you, but I know from the work that I've done over the years, it's, you know, it could be 4 months, it could be 6 months, it could be 9 months. There is a lag effect, and a 25-year chart of the S&P 2-year and the 210 that I looked at recently, it reflects that very well. I just can't tell you, and nobody else can. But the longer that it sits there, Peter is 100% right. It doesn't matter until it's staring them in the face, and especially now because you have so much of these passive indexers who I think, you know, everything's just by the dip, especially because funds are available and people are looking for investment opportunities. You know, why not? But I still remember February 2018 is still fresh in my mind. And for a lot of people, there was a lot of wounds there. So, again, that was looking them right in the face, and then they panicked. But you know what? Everything in time.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agreed.
And so what is the implication of the flattening of U.S. yield curves? Is there a forecasting of a potential U.S. recession, Ira?
Well, you know what? That's what they've typically done. How far out? Again, difficult to measure because let's go back to 2007, which is a great 2007, 2008. But 2007, that curve steadily flattened until it inverted to negative 6 basis points. The Fed, I can remember January of 2007, the Bank of England raised rates very unexpectedly. Tim Bessley had given a speech where I thought there was a possibility, but the market was really caught off by it. But that was really the last hike. And then the markets and the curve inverted, in the U.S. curve inverted, and then everybody started getting a little bit nervous. And as Peter talks about, as the Fed started to ease off on the pedal, in fact, reverse the other way, then, of course, we reversed and the market took solace in that. But the underlying economy had already fractured so badly that, you know, we know what happened come 2008.
Peter, your thoughts on the flattening of the U.S. yield curve?
I think that there's a lot of there is still predictive power in it, but we have to understand that when the Fed starts raising interest rates, at least the last two rate hike cycles, it's paid to flatten the curve. So this is really just following the same path that we've previously seen, and we have to understand that we have credit cycles now, not economic cycles. So when the cost of money starts to tighten, at some point, in a credit-dependent economy and an interest rate-sensitive economy, it's going to impact growth. Now, there's no question that a 30-basis-point yield in the German 10-year could be exaggerating the flattening versus what it would do otherwise. But and one other point I think that I've been really believing in is that where, you know, the textbook tells you that long-term bonds are most sensitive to changes of inflation because of its duration, longer to the short term. I think in this cycle, it's really been the short end that has been absorbing rising inflation expectations. And even you look at today, you had this very hot PPI, and the two-year yield is at 2.58%, or 2 basis points from the highest level in 11 years, because the PPI number, and likely to be followed by the CPI number, continuing to rise means that the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates, while the long end knows, okay, Fed keeps getting deeper into this rate hike cycle, something's going to break. We've already seen breakage in Turkey and Argentina and Brazil and certainly Italy. And they see what's going on with tariffs. And I think the bond market is certainly more clear on the economic impact of this tariff stuff, more so than equities, which rallied in the S&P 80 points in 4 days on the actual implementation of Chinese tariffs. So I think that the flattening is for real. It should not be ignored. Again, it could be exaggerated by low rates overseas, but I think bond guys know what happens when you get deeper into a rate hike cycle and how it typically ends.
Mm-hmm. That's a good observation, yeah. And just before we get into further discussion on tariffs and trade wars, Ira, you mentioned, you point out the 2-10 two-year, 10-year Treasury yield curve relationship to gold. Can you elaborate on that as far as a correlation?
It's definitely, you can chart it out. But, you know, as somebody else put out a chart this morning correlating gold with actually the yuan action. So as the yuan has weakened, gold has weakened. I'm not sure about that correlation, but it certainly makes me aware that, you know, it's something else I have to pay attention to. That one kind of spooks me to think that that's the case, because we would assume the other. We would assume the other. And the other is that as the currency would weaken, that gold would actually become a safer haven. But it's not, or we haven't seen it as of yet. So that, you know, certainly bears watching. Well, let me pivot back to what Peter was talking about with the Fed. And this is going to be interesting here, as long as we're going to get into the Fed. Because if the Fed keeps raising rates and things tighten more, because I think this flattening is more because, number one, you know, again, we go back to that really wonderful piece written by Governor Patel of the Reserve Bank of India, mm-hmm. you know, warning about the three things that were affecting the world. And I think he was exactly right, which is increased Treasury borrowing on the front end. The Treasury is, you know, floating enormous amount of debt. The raising of the Fed funds rate. And of course, as Peter, far before anybody else was using it, you know, highlighted about the coming effects of quantitative easing. So those three things. So I'm going to begin to wonder when the commander in chief starts tweeting about the Fed. He won't be the first president to go, you know, Nixon famously, you know, they've gone at the Fed. Truman had his issues with the Fed. But he's going to put Powell and the Fed in his crosshairs. And I think that's when we're really going to see a ramp up in market volatility when Trump starts going after the Fed.
And Peter,
and we can be sure it'll start with his Twitter feed, no question.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So on the Reserve Bank of India, Urjit Patel, Peter, do you agree on his view that the Fed's recent actions, coupled with increased U.S. Treasury demands for funding, are leading to a global funding crisis?
Well, we're headed to some funding issues of some sort, whether it's a crisis, we'll have to see. But there's no question. I mean, that's what QT is. It's draining liquidity out of the financial system. It's taking dollars out of the system. I think what's most noteworthy is that beginning in Q3, between the Fed taking out $40 billion a month, the ECB only adding, in dollar terms, $35 billion a month, that we now have a net draw liquidity from these two central banks for the first time in this cycle. And that will get even more exaggerated come Q4, when the Fed is taking out $50 billion and the ECB is going to be adding only $17.5 billion. And then, of course, they'll be adding nothing come January of next year. So stuff happens when liquidity flow goes the other way. And, you know, I mentioned earlier Turkey and Argentina and Italy, and the short vol trade blowing up. I mean, it's no coincidence that all of a sudden stuff like this begins to happen because investors become more, less tolerant of things, of issues. I mean, look, Turkey's had political problems for years. Now all of a sudden they care. Italy, like now they have political issues now, like they haven't had political issues in the past with 65 governments in 70 years. But the 2-year note yield goes from minus 30 basis points to 2.5 in 2 weeks. You know, these are canaries that that are whistling, and we're going to get more of this the deeper we get with the Fed and as the ECB gets closer to ending QE.
Ira, you mentioned how the Fed is curtailing liquidity while raising rates. How do you see the effects of this happening on massive global debt levels?
Well, you know, listen, again, Peter, and I'll say Jimmy Bianco, too, have been all over this for a long time, the massive growth in global debt. And I know Danielle Booth Martino, she's written about it, too. It's been enormous. So, you know, that's all well and good as long as the debt can be serviced. But as interest rates are going up, and, of course, they're going up on the short end, which so much of this debt is tied to LIBOR-type floating rates. So the effect is immediate. Only the best companies have been able to really issue longer-term debt. You know, Apple, Microsoft, but everybody else, you know, all these other corporations who are doing stock buybacks and dividends and borrowing money to do it are financing it on the short end. And this is going to, this is one of those overhangs that could really begin to affect this market quickly. And I think the stock market is trying to whistle past the graveyard on this. And I think the raise in the cost of servicing this debt is going to easily wipe out whatever gains have accrued from the tax cut, which are based, you know, which will have, as other people have talked about, all you've done is bring forward demand, as you know, in the initial space of the tax cuts. But as we go forward here, I don't think you're going to get as much growth as people are talking about in the next couple of years because of this.
And Peter, your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, we're late cycle here. We're clearly running up against a lot of supply constraints in the economy, whether it's finding labor, whether it's getting a truck to deliver your pallet to a customer. And we have the Fed tightening. I mean, I like to always use what David Rosenberg has said, that the last 13 rate hike cycles since World War II, 10 put us into recession. And why should this really be any different? I mean, the odds of a soft landing are so small, and considering how extreme this easing was, when it reverses, I mean, how do we not expect there to be some sort of impact? I mean, I guess with the equity market, there's this belief that we will get a soft landing and the economy is so strong because of tax cuts that it can deal with any of these externalities. But, you know, as I said earlier, it's credit that drives the U.S. economy. It's not savings. We have a tremendous lack of savings. We have a tremendous dependency on credit. Mm-hmm. If the credit markets start to tighten for whatever reason, that's going to have major economic implications. To what Ira basically said, depending on where you can, you know, finance yourself.
And Peter, you've also recently looked into earnings reports and how they are reflecting trade wars in terms of tariffs. Can you elaborate?
Well, in the next couple of weeks, every company is going to be either asked or is going to talk about what the impact is. And I want to emphasize for people that you don't have to be in the industrial heartland or a manufacturer of some sort to be the only one that is affected by tariffs. So when you hear of an economic analysis saying, okay, well, there's $50 billion of tariffs or $60 billion in total, it's X amount of GDP, it's small, it's not going to have that much of a difference. What is not in these econometric models are the spillover effects. What's the business that a restaurant is going to do that happens to be near the Mercedes plant in Alabama, because Mercedes is now, they're now shipping less autos to China because of the tariff. Well, less people are going to go to that restaurant. That calculation is not in these econometric models right now. A law firm that does a lot of business with industrial companies, well, maybe they're going to start doing less business. So the ripple effect, I believe, is a lot more broader than just the basic calculate the tariff dollars and do it divide by GDP and say, okay, this is the impact. Also with the tariffs is you have to almost double count them, because if we're going to put $50 billion of tariffs on China, they're going to put $50 billion on us. Well, that's a $100 billion number on the global economy. So we can't just look at it to see what it is on our side. Mm-hmm. We have to look at it in the aggregate.
And Ira, your thoughts?
Well, I agree totally with Peter, but I'm going to raise another issue, and this is one that we've talked about before. The effect, let's say, and we're looking at it right in the, right now with soybeans. And I've been bullish grains, and I still think that once this clears, that the grain markets will turn up, because I think there's massive demand out there. Yeah. But now what's the Trump answer? They're going to start subsidizing farmers. So wait a minute, you're putting on these tariffs. It's being counter-tariffed. Whatever money you're going to raise through these tariffs, which is a tariff is a tax on incoming goods, you're going to turn around and give to the farmers anyway. So tell me what this exercise has been.
Yeah.
And all you're doing is possibly losing markets because you're forcing your biggest buyer to go search elsewhere. Yes, I know the fungibility of grains. I certainly understand that. So I don't get that. What? Then you know what? Then take the politics out of it. William Poole had a great piece last week. But take the politics out of it. Don't subsidize the farmers. Put the tariffs on and let things work out. Why are you subsidizing the farmers? I know why, because it's politics. And the Chinese understand that politics just as well. So you just keep chasing your tail. Nobody talks to each other. You know, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand here is doing. You know, as the tweets flow out, then we get reactive policy rather than proactive policy. And that's where we're at. And the response to the pain of the farmers, which is always the case historically. You know, again, I advise anybody who wants to have a good slog, read Professor Irwin's book, Douglas Irwin, on the clashing over commerce, which is a history of 230 years of U.S. trade practices. It's very enlightening. And you see, as with everything else, when you do these kinds of things, there's always a give get, and who's going to pay the piper? Right now, the farmers are paying the piper, but you're taking the tax and just giving it back to them. So I'm not sure what your real outcome is, except for bad.
Comments on that, Peter?
Yeah, no, I agree. It's pure politics. I mean, Trump should go to Iowa and explain how his negotiating tactics are going to be eventually good for them, as they're a few months from harvesting a crop with soybean prices at a 10-year low. So there's no coincidence that he tweeted out today about the American farmer. So, what's the point? I think the problem is that we, as the weeks go on, we get deeper in this. People just want to hear that we're negotiating with China, that we have them at the table. Right now, there's no evidence of that. Maybe there's back channel discussions, but at least on the surface, China is showing no signs of backing off. Now, I get why Trump is attacking China in terms of technology stealing and transfer through joint ventures. I get all that, but isn't there another way of negotiating rather than causing an earthquake in the global economy through all these tariffs and damaging the livelihood of a lot of American businesses and consumers that are now going to be paying up, and they're paying now 25% more for washing machines because of the washing machine tariff of a few months ago?
It's always about, you know, again, somebody benefits and somebody gets hurt. But I here's where politically, and as long as we're on the political end of this, I think it's going to backfire on Trump, because there's a lot of Republican congresspeople, especially senators, who are opposed to these tariffs because there's no real plan to it. It's just willy-nilly jumping around, you know, whatever comes out of Navarro's mouth today or Wilbur Ross yesterday, and then Kudlow walks it back. But he's got a Supreme Court nominee coming up. If I was a Republican senator who was opposed to these tariffs, I'd let it be known I will not support before the November elections the Supreme Court nominee and watch it die on the vine. I think that the White House is tactically, they may have a strategic plan here, but they're terrible tacticians. And I think that's what we're seeing here. And I think he's going to pay a dear price for it. So let's watch the way this unfolds. But if I was one of those Republican senators, and I was angry about the tariffs, you'd hear a lot from me. And a lot of those Republican senators are in red agricultural states. So Trump could wind up with a real problem here.
Yeah, I agree with what I was saying, because at the end of the day, it's these congressmen that have to answer to the constituency. It's that congressman in Iowa that needs to explain to their farmers. That's where you get down to the roots of this from who it's affecting. It's not Trump that's going to fly to Iowa. It's the congressmen and women in Iowa that are going to have to make those explanations, and Illinois and Nebraska, and to use just that one product. But we know it's affecting hundreds of others.
And it's
Paul Ryan in Wisconsin who's going to have to talk to Harley Davidson, to use another example.
Mm-hmm. The effects of all these tariffs and trade war actions, Ira, you've recently raised the question of, is this going to lead to stagflation? And will central banks allow inflation or raise interest rates as the question? Your thoughts on that?
Well, we've all lived through the period of Bernanke and Yellen transitory inflation, when they didn't want to raise rates because they were afraid of spooking the market and ending Bernanke's beloved portfolio balance channel. So those inflation movements, back when grain prices soared, oil prices soared, those were transitory elements. So are we going to hear from the Powell Fed about, transitory nature of price increases due to tariffs? Because we know tariffs are taxes. When you apply a tax, prices are going to go up. How will they show? How will they center? Or will they react to them and go, hey, you know what? This is having a greater effect than we thought. Will we raise rates? But if they start raising rates or they start talking more hawkish, that's when the Trump tweets in the night will be going off, and Jerome Powell will be the target. And I'm going to go out on a limb and venture this, because it's interesting and that Trump, he marches to his own beat. But the one, Larry Summers has been out there agreeing with Larry Kudlow about the that the Fed ought not to be raising rates, that inflation and the whole Phillips curve is not as relevant as it was. So I it's not even tongue in cheek. Watch, Trump still has one or two appointments left to the Fed governors. It wouldn't shock me to see Trump choose like Larry Summers, because Larry Summers has no chance of being nominated by the Democrats, because after he was beaten back in 2013 by what I would say, I'm pretty sure about this, 90% sure, that the Lizzie Warren wing beat him back, because he was going to be the Fed chairman, but he wasn't going to get through that that group. So he fell on the vine, and Obama wasn't going to risk the political capital to fall on a sword for him. But it'd be interesting to see if in fact, because Larry Summers is very vocal speaking about the Fed is moving too aggressively. So let's watch what happens there. But I know that Trump tweet is going to start going off about, and it's going to be directed at the Fed over this issue.
And it's ironic that he's saying the Fed's tightening too fast. PPI printed a 7-year high at 3.4%. CPI is about to print almost 3%, with the core rate now moving near 2.5%. And this is before the tariffs really kick in. So you have these large amount of inflation pressures before the tariffs even kick in. I mean, the Fed's in a really tough situation here.
Hmm. And so do you think central banks will allow inflation or continue to raise interest rates?
Every central banker will always allow higher inflation if it means growth is still on track. They will give up inflation as long as they have growth, which is a mistake, because you need low inflation in order to get sustainable growth. So it's a fallacy of central bank thinking. But, it's the same thing that happened in the late 70s. They were all focused on unemployment, were afraid to deal with the rise in inflation. And, there was obviously a major accident that had to be dealt with. You look at the Bank of England, their mandate is price stability. And Mark Carney has failed miserably. He's sitting there with their benchmark rate of 50 basis points while they've been printing 2% plus inflation for a couple of years now. How do you have a healthy economy when the standard of living of your populace is declining because you can't control inflation? You've let the pound collapse because of your policy, in addition to Brexit, but he was paralyzed by Brexit. He was afraid that an interest rate hike here and there would damage the economy. So here's a guy that took his eye off his mandate, focused more on the job situation. So now Mark Carney's in a situation where, okay, he'll raise rates next month to 75 basis points. But let's just say we go into a downturn the next couple of years. He's going to have no ability. Well, first of all, he'll probably be gone by then, but whoever replaces him will have no ability to deal with any problems that come their way, because Mark Carney couldn't find the way to deal with higher inflation by raising interest rates. Even the Bank of Canada has rates at 1.5%, and Mark Carney is being pulled kicking and screaming, going from 50 basis points to 75.
And finally, let's look at what of all of these factors are doing into China. Do you think that China needs to make up its mind whether they want to help support their currency or whether they want to support their economy? Ira?
Well, you know, I would go back to the podcast we did, Richard, with Barry Eichengreen, because I think his point is well taken. I don't think you'll see an intentional depreciation of the currency by the Chinese, because right now it's the U.S. and Trump that's isolated. And I think if the Chinese were to move to aggressively promote a depreciation of the currency, it wouldn't play well with a lot of the other players in the global system. And I think they have to be very careful with that. I think what we saw was that there was money fleeing China because there's been some slowing. Look at, you know, copper prices have dropped dramatically. Australia is, you know, softening a little bit. So everything around it is reflecting that, you know, the Chinese economy is struggling. And as, you know, as we pointed out at the beginning, the correlation with a weaker yuan coupled with a weaker with weaker equity index just flies in the face of conventional wisdom. So there may be problems in China, but I think the idea of depreciating your currency really would harm China in its quest for global legitimacy. So I wouldn't expect that. I think they could take the punches or the jabs. I'm not even calling them punches. The jabs from the U.S. And they'll punch back, or they'll jab back in their own way. You know, tariffs on this and tariffs on that, and we're not going to buy your soybeans. But they can play that game. But that's because the Trump administration mistimed this whole thing anyway. Because when they decided to do this, it was right into the middle of a massive Latin American grain harvest. So the Chinese can satisfy all the grain that they want, coupled with weaker currency, especially the Brazilian real, while the Argentinian currency has dropped dramatically. So in local currency terms, the Chinese are able to purchase grain at a severe discount. And they're buying so much of the Latin America, especially Brazilian grain, that there is a premium at the port because there's so much, you know, being shipped out. So I Ross and Navarro, I have very little respect for them. If they were going to do this, they should have waited until the harvest was totally done and sales had already been spoken for. And then the Chinese would have been in a much more difficult situation and would not have been able to as dramatically affect the outcome of, or the potential outcome of, the 2018 November election. Because one thing farmers look at is their bank book. You know, and the farm income, which had risen dramatically for the previous, you know, from 2008 probably to 2015, has been hurt for the last 3 years, or at least they've been crying, but farmers, especially in the Midwest where I come from, are always crying. But right now they are getting hurt as prices, as Peter pointed out, prices dropped to 11-year lows in the soybeans or 10-year lows. This is, you know, fairly dramatic, and they will go into the voting booths, which have been very pro-Trump, with a bad taste in her mouth. So I think the White House has muffed this terribly.
And Peter, finally, what do you make of what's happening in China with both currency and equity markets going down at the same time? Is that indicative of a slowdown in China?
Well, I think there's no question. I don't think, though, that China wants to see its currency fall very far. I think they understand that a lot of these, there's inflationary implications to these tariffs. And by having a currency that's stable will allow the Chinese people to deal with the higher cost of stuff that they import. But as you said, I do think it's reflective of an economy that's slowing. People realize that there's still an enormous amount of debt that China is trying to get themselves out from under, and that this deleveraging, or not really deleveraging, it's trying to slow excessive credit growth, is going to inevitably slow growth overall. Now, the Chinese economy has hung in pretty well. Luckily, they have, over the years, they're going to be relying less and less on the U.S. I mean, that's the one long-term implication of this, is that China realizes that we know we need to expand our customer base away from the U.S. What is happening now is just going to accelerate that. And so there are long-term implications to what is going on right now.
Well, great insight as always. Gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work, Ira?
Well, I haven't been writing as much lately because the themes that, are just, consistently reflecting some sense of stability, and markets are just kind of, as I say, in the doldrums as they're waiting for the winds of volatility to arise. But I'm still writing notes from underground. I'm probably publishing once or twice a week, markets depending, sometimes less. So that's how they can follow me. They can go to Ira Harris, YiraHarris.com, and connect to Notes from Underground and get the latest blogs. And you can go back and read, because as you know, especially with these podcasts, these are all things we've been talking about for 2 or 3 years already. And I know Peter's been writing about them. So these are not new for us. So it gets a little old. I mean, that's the way I feel. But, here it is, and it's a reality. So, you got to deal now with the present reality.
Yes, exactly. And Peter?
Listeners can go to bookreport.com, BOOCKreport.com, and they can sample my daily writings. And if they're interested in investment advice or any other wealth management advice, they can go to bleakley.com and reach out to me.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.